welcome to the CG Pro podcast. This is episode 59. And today we have with us the amazing and prolific Haz Dalul. Welcome, Haz. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, man. I just realized, like, episode 59? Wow.
Yeah, I know. God. Episode 59. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I can't believe it myself as well. And you've been on this before. Unfortunately,
I have. You're
you're so prolific that you have to keep bringing you back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, as always.
Well, I appreciate you being back. Yeah, for everybody joining us, you can follow us at becomecgpro.com or in our free Facebook group. Hope you enjoy today's episode. So, Haz, for anyone who doesn't know Haz, anyone who's into Unreal probably does, but Haz is a director and originally visual effects artist, director, has directed lots of things like films and game cinematics and short films, and it is known for cross media, creating things now in both all the formats, in a feature film that's a game that's also a UEFN experience. So welcome. It's great to have you here, man.
Thank you.
Cool. Well, I feel like at this point I've probably asked you about your life story enough times that we don't have to go down that road. Do you think you've been on this podcast? You win the record for a number of times of being on here. I'd love to have you back because you've just done so many things since the last time you were on. I think it was episode 34 that you were on.
Yeah. Last time. I mean, you know what it's like, man. You know, it's just as fast as Epic updates Unreal, there's always things that's always happening, right? You know, like I remember when I started Unreal Engine, I started using Unreal 4.19 doing previs, and then went into 4.24 to do this test sequence called Mutiny at Zero, which ended up going on the Epic Spotlight, which ended up getting me a gig to direct my current feature film, Mutiny at Zero, with Funcom, the games company. And then end up just making a full animated feature in version 4.26.2 called Rift, which comes out early next year. We're in distribution at the moment. And then, like, you know, we're now in Unreal Engine 5. You know, like I said, we're doing the animated film. We're doing video games as well. We're doing this video game called Max Beyond, which is a spin-off from Rift. And this is with ID at Xbox, which is independent developers program for Xbox. So we have Xbox dev kits, which is bizarre because, you know, I remember working in the games industry, getting a dev kit was like the luxury. So we actually have two, which is nice. And they've been great to work with. And then, like, we just launched a Fortnite game. I can't believe I said the words. I've just launched a Fortnite game. I never thought I'd say that like, you know, 6 months ago. Right. So it just shows you so much happens with technology and how much technology influences you as a creator, the type of work you do and how you do it and when you do it.
Right. Yeah. It's a really interesting point to bring up at the beginning and seeing, tracking the evolution of using just one piece of software, let alone any other supplementary tools that you guys use to create things in Unreal, but Unreal itself being the container, the hub. What's it been like watching its evolution over the last number of years?
It's interesting, dude, because, like, you know, we set the production company with Unreal being at the core center of the entire pipeline. You know, unlike other visual effects companies or production houses, they have a bunch of tools and they plug Unreal in. We set the company with Unreal in the center, and everything else, like Maya, Cinema 4D, Blender, Realusion iClone, Substance Paint, and everything plugs directly into Unreal. And once it comes into Unreal, it stays in Unreal. And then the only time that, you know, we get something out of Unreal is whether we're rendering out frames or we're doing a compile build for a video game. So it's two things. Firstly, it allows us to keep our pipeline very consistent. It allows us to grow as Unreal grows. Because let's face it, Unreal isn't that finished piece of software. It's like being in an advanced beta stage of a software that keeps getting evolving all the time, which is amazing, you know, which is why, you know, now it's free for now. And, you know, as the creators help build it. But then, the other thing also is I can select the sort of people I want to work on the projects that I lead, literally based on their work, not based on the software they use. So, like, you know, we have character artists that use Blender. Fine. Your character work is amazing. I don't care what software you use. As long as we can bring it into Unreal, then it's great. So we have, you know, our head of CG, Andrea Tateci, he spent years building a pipeline that allows that to happen so that, you know, we have systems to bring in Alembic very nicely. We have very clean naming conventions. We have specific ways of working with assets all from all over the world of artists that we work with. And it's great because, you know, it means that we get to work with the people that we want to work with based on their work, but also allows us to grow the team in more of an international way as well.
That's cool. Yeah. And kind of a unique time in that sense. We're very helped by the pandemic. Lots of things weren't helped by the pandemic, but that was one thing that was, right, is the ability to convincing studios that it's possible to do it, but then also the rise of independent creators being able to, like yourself, to be able to grow teams more easily.
Absolutely. Yeah. We learned so much being as an awful event in humanity. At the same time, it's opened the doors for a lot of people that not necessarily had the opportunities, because there's always these gatekeepers, and the gatekeepers being the studios, right? Let's face it, studios. And they are the ones that will say yes or no to projects. And usually the yes or no is depending on where you're based. If you're based in Los Angeles or in the UK or something. But also, like, they're so used to, like, you've got to shoot a movie in a studio. You've got to build an animation studio to do animation. You've got to do mocap in a big OctuTrack stage. And then, like, through pandemic, we saw the rise of XN suits being used, Rococo and Perception Neuron. And now we're seeing things like Plask and Move AI 1, where you're using video footage on your iPhone to create mocap. All of this stuff is being inspired because people are working from home and they want to create content very quickly. You know, I speak to some really amazing directors out there that are now saying that it's great to have the luxury to experiment, to try things out without the burden of like, oh, I've got to go raise some money with a production company. Oh, I've got to check in with the producers to see if we can find bandwidth. They're like, no, I can just like boot my laptop and try something out, really find the voice for this film before I go out and pitch it. And even the whole pitching stage as well has changed massively over the pandemic because of things like real time. You know, like back in the day, if you wanted to do a big pitch on a commercial, you know, yes, you're looking at 10, 20, 30 grand's worth to, you know, to shoot a pitch, and you don't know you're going to get that job, right? And you've just wasted 30 grand if you don't get that gig. Whereas now, you know, with things like real time, you know, with things like Unreal, with things like, you know, Move AI or anything like that, you know, within a couple of days, you can set a pitch going, get the look going and pitch it, and make changes on the fly. And also just collaborate with people all over the world very efficiently, and it doesn't cost you a lot of money compared to what it was before. And I think all of that is, that's why I was saying at the start of our conversation, technology has got a big, massive influence to how this industry is shaping massively. And it's going to continue with things like AI and so on.
A very exciting time. I've not seen this much innovation in the whole time I've been working in computer graphics professionally. It's very cool.
Yes.
Considering your path, having worked in bigger companies and studios and then branching off and creating your own films and IP, and now being where we are today with the accessibility of tools and, as you said, people being able to create themselves, what would you recommend for somebody starting out, aspiring to get to where you are in making your own stuff? Would you like start by doing that? Would you still recommend going to work for a studio and getting mentoring? What thoughts do you have?
That's a really good question. I get asked that a lot. Like I always say, what would I do differently like 15 years ago or 20 years ago when I started out or something? And I probably wouldn't change it. I think it's so important to be able to work at a company when you're starting out, and really understand how big studios work, so that when you do go out on your own, you appreciate it more. Like I appreciate the luxury I have as a filmmaker and company co-owner to be able to try things out, be able to move the camera in a certain way using virtual cameras, to be able to kind of break the rules a little bit in order to get what I want. But I've got to understand the rules in the first place. And to understand the rules in the first place, you've got to work at studios. You know, just like, you know, I worked at MPC. I worked at, you know, some big studios. Even when I directed my first TV shows with Disney, and Disney is a machine, the way you work as a director in television, you literally just plug into this big machine, which is a lovely machine, by the way. I learned so much working in writer's room, showrunners and so on. And even working on feature films that are, you know, financed by other financiers and you're literally a hired director, you know, that's a whole different thing. But you learn the process of like the do's and the don'ts and the things that work for you and things that don't work for you. And also the restrictions that you have when you're working with a big studio that you can't necessarily, like, for example, if you're in a big studio and you want to like change a shot, kind of can't do that. You kind of have to run it through various levels of like management before you get a sign off. Whereas when you're in your own studio, you can just do that. I can change it. You know, I can make, it's no longer a donkey. Now it's a pink elephant because I can see what that looks like. But I always advise people to get as much experience, not just at big studios. Like even before I started, you know, remember I started in video games back in 98, right? And then I wanted to like work in movies because I remember saying the famous words, right? I ain't making movies in a game engine. Who does that? right? So I went to work in visual effects. So I went to work in visual effects. But before working in visual effects, I didn't have the showreel or the portfolio because, you know, back then, you know, games and film were like two separate camps. And, you know, admittedly, the film people were very snobbery. Like, oh, you work in games. Yeah, we make movies. We're the big boys here. So I remember having to start from the bottom up, like being a rotoscope artist. And I still today thank myself for starting at such a junior position. Even though I was a senior cinematics artist at places like Codemasters and Kuju Entertainment working on Nintendo games, I decided to go back down to the bottom because that's how you have to start off if you're a composer, right? You can't go straight as a compa. And being a roto artist, feeling the pain of cutting out things and trying to like do the in-betweens for things where CG gets, you know, put behind the character and stuff because something's badly shot or because there's a rig in the shot or the green screen wasn't lit properly. Someone didn't tie the green screen down and it's flapping, all kinds of stuff, right? You know, you know what I mean? And then when I became a VFX supervisor, I'm like, hell no, I'm not getting my artists do that. And then when I became a filmmaker, I'm like, no, I'm going to plan properly. I'm going to communicate to the visual effects house as succinctly as possible, kind of work two ways. Like, you know, if something can't be done in visual effects because it's so expensive, then because of my compositing background, I'm able to have a conversation with the VFX supervisor. Hey, listen, I've been there. I feel you. So let's figure out something together to get that shot that I need because the studio is paying me as a director to get that shot. But I don't want you guys burning out. So how do we work this? And if I wasn't a visual effects artist, then I wouldn't have been that kind of director or that kind of producer, where I understand. So yeah, the long-winded answer to your question is get as much experience when you come start. And like I said, you can, you know, work big studios or you can just go and help out on a couple of short films. Like before I got the job at MPC, because my showreel was too CG, apparently they wanted live action and I'd never shot live action. So I just went on like shootingpeople.com, you know, that website back in the day. Yeah. And just volunteered to help out. And now, you know, people can do that online on Unreal Films and so on. But get as much experience and fail fast. It's a big thing I always ask people is fail fast when you're starting out because you don't have a lot to lose when you're starting out because, you know, you're figuring stuff out and you're working on short films. They're not like big studio movies that's going to cost millions. So definitely, yeah, just, and I think it's a little bit easier today than it was back then. I mean, it's still hard now, but it's a little bit easier in terms of like, you know, we have such a great community of people that are sharing stuff that want people to help. I mean, for example, we have an amazing cinematics artist. He's also a director as well, Mark Cheng, who works with us. We just found each other via Facebook. Like, you know, he's like, hey, man, I love your stuff. I'm like, hey, I love your werewolf short. It was freaking amazing. He goes, oh, cool. How do we work together? Well, I'm not really hiring right now because, you know, we're self-funded. But like, if you want to help out in some shots. And he did. He helped out. And we ended up hiring him. He's working on Dune with me at the moment. And, it, you know, he was telling me the other day, like, he just couldn't imagine working on a big AAA game. And in the fact that we just found each other because we just shared work on Facebook. So it works. It really does work.
Right. And the clue there that you slipped in there was by sharing. Online, you give
100%
people permission to, or you give them the reason to connect with you because
100%
they can see what you're about and what you're into and what you're capable of.
Oh God, yeah. Like people remember people because of the work they do. Like, you know, when Mark Cheng reached out, I was like, Mark Cheng, I don't really know the name. Oh, the werewolf film. Oh my God, that was dope. I remember. Or like some other person reached out to me recently. And I remember because I was on the fellowship jury thing. And I'm like, I saw your fellowship short. That was freaking cool. You did that. And all of a sudden there's a connection, you know? So, and I think today, like the more you share, the better. You know, you have your Instagrams, you have your TikToks. But I feel like people are just like, especially me, when I'm looking for content to inspire me. I'm not looking just looking at the big studio movies. I'm looking at anyone that's making cool stuff. To me, that stuff inspires me. And sometimes I end up hiring. Like, you know, I've mentioned before on the last podcast, but like Gabriella, who's this amazing motion capture technical artist and a million amazing things she does. Like, same thing. You know, she helped us out on mocap and now she's just blowing up massively. And it's just amazing to see the growth of people. And I feel like when you do that, you are grown with the community. It's such a different way of working than it was, say, back in the day where you are hired as a VFX supervisor to bring someone on, you grow their career. This feels more of a communal thing. And I think that's going to get bigger and bigger over the years.
Fantastic. Yeah, I think it's really inspired a lot. I was inspired a lot by Epic and where they've grown their community and the way that the tools have been built to be able to collaborate on things in real time become more of a community whilst you're working on something. Whereas I know before, probably the same for you, we were all like, even in the same room, but we're all like on a desk with our headphones on. Yeah. We don't really talk to the person that's next to us. And now we communicate more with the people that we're working with online than we
did
the same room.
Oh yeah, but we use Discord. We also use Slack as well. Like for like the bigger studio projects we work on, we use Slack because obviously the studio team have Slack and it's secure and all that stuff. But we use Discord internally and it's great. Like sometimes I forget that the people I'm talking to are like in a different country. We've recently set up an office in Belfast and that's a physical office. That's our first physical office. I don't think we've ever had a physical office. We always set the company up working like remotely. And we've set this one up in Belfast. My business partner, Paula Crickard, is running that. And we're hiring a lot of like talent from Northern Ireland, Belfast specifically. But we're all on Discord talking, all the production managers and assistants and everyone. It's just so nice that you feel like you're not alone when you're stuck on stuff. And sometimes I'll just see a thread or see a meeting room active and I'll just like listen in. And obviously they're like, hey, Haz, we can see you're in. I'm like, oh, damn. But it's just nice to see that everyone's working together. And when people's got problems, they're, hey, look, I am stuck. And they share a video clip of what they're stuck on. And you see everyone on the team just diving, hey, you forgot to press this button. So cool. I don't know what that would be like if it was all in the same building or stuff, but I feel like, I know. I feel like since Discord and Slack and just that whole way of working remotely has really, I know, it's kind of like encouraged people to be more communicate better, more. Like for me, even as a director, I'm being much more succinct and when I'm giving instructions or directions or trying to motivate a team to do something. Like you got to be more short and succinct and to the point. Show as much visual references and all of that stuff. And I think all of that is just because of the way we work today.
It's going to be interesting to see where it goes. I feel like we haven't quite seen what that is capable of online, how we're capable of connecting. I think in 5 years' time, that will look really different. I'm really excited about how that's going to be because I feel in some ways it's more isolating being remote. In some ways, it's more connected. It's interesting.
That's a really good way of looking at it, actually, man, because I'm actually excited the fact that we have a physical office in Belfast. Mainly because you could just all be in the same room, you know, like on the current move we're working on at the moment, Meet Near Zero, we have this thing on Wednesdays, like 4 PM, 5 PM in LA time, like in the morning. And we're just all jumping on, sharing storyboards, going through script notes. And everyone's got their Zoom cameras on. You can see what their rooms are like and stuff. And it does feel very communal, even at a high level and sort of like senior producing management side of things, it still feels quite communal. And then when an artist jumps in, it doesn't feel so separate. It feels like, oh, we're literally in the same room.
Yeah. Yeah, it's super cool. Maybe one day we'll be in I don't want to call it the M word, but in some sort of 3D connected environment.
The M word.
Which brings us nicely on to talking about Unreal for Fortnite. And I know you've been digging into that heavily since we sat next to each other at GDC and saw the announcement and all of the crazy other stuff that was announced at that event. I'll never forget looking at you and being like, is this where we are now?
That was a historical moment, dude. The fact that we both queued up as well to get in there, because the queue was long to get in and we got a seat. And I remember like when they showed off UEFN, I remember like looking over to you, we're like, this is a game changer. And like literally, like I remember like going back on the plane and I'm thinking, oh my God, like all the stuff that we're, because we were working on like metaverse projects beforehand, right? And we had to build everything from scratch and everything. And I'm seeing Fortnite, I'm like, this is insane. Because you know, not only is it like you have an audience already in place, which is as an independent creator very, very hard to do, because you know, unless you're a studio like Disney or so on, where you've already got a grown audience already and you just make content, you know it's going straight to that audience, right? Whereas when you're an independent creator, like you have to build your audience. That is just as much work as making the content. It's just as much work as raising the finance to make your content. So when I saw the UEFN, I'm like, hold up, not only do we have tools already built for us to do game mechanics and all of that stuff that takes a long time to make, we can move all our Unreal Engine assets into the world of Fortnite and it doesn't need to look like Fortnite, but also there's a potential 500 million plus user base that my content can be seen. Like, sign me up. So I remember like going back to the London and I'm like, what can we do, because like, you know, as a production company, IP is kind of like our currency. It's kind of like, you know, when you're a studio, all you have is what your IP. That's what defines you as a company. You know, we're not a servicing company. Now, if we were a visual effects company, then our roster of clients we work with would be, you know, our currency, right? But for us, we're not a service company. We produce original IP. So I'm like, so if I do something in UEFN, it's got to have original IP. But original IP takes a while to create, you know, especially from the ground up. They create the world, the lore, the script. Most importantly, why are we telling that story in the world of Fortnite? Then I remembered we had developed a bunch of projects. Now, every studio does this, whether you're small or big. You have a slate of projects, right? And we had one project actually called Moontopia, which was an animated series we were developing all in Unreal Engine 5 like last year. I remember flying to Annecy, the French Film Festival, and showing that teaser trailer. And it was great, got some good receptions. And then as I was walking around meeting, you know, distributors and studios, they kind of like put the fear of God in me. Like, making an animated TV show is very expensive. It's it takes a lot of time. You got to build a writer's room, all of that stuff. And I'm like, okay, well, we're kind of really busy on our features and stuff. So we just parked it. Bear in mind, we built a teaser trailer and everything, right? So we parked it. So when the UEFN thing came up, I'm like, well, why don't we just take all of the stuff we did in the teaser trailer, migrate that into a UEFN project? Not only do we have the world, we have characters built, we have a universe built, we have a story. It's not being exposed to the public apart from the festival. And also, I kind of want to get some return back. Some ROI, right. You know, teaser that we spent. Because that's the thing people forget, dude, is the fact that when you run a company, everything that you do kind of has a monetary value attached to it. Like, my time has a monetary value attached to it. If I get, say, Sam from my team to help me out on environment lighting, and he takes 2 days, that's 2 days of what he's getting paid, that has to go somewhere. And that's where your producer's hat kicks in. You're like, oh, okay, so that accounts. So we spent money. So this would be a good way to recoup if we do it well. So I remember the first thing we did was I had to convince my team to do a UEFN project. Like, and that's the thing people don't realize also is that, you know, a lot of times I'm pitching to financiers, to studios, to finance projects, but I'm also pitching to my team to make sure that they're on board. Right. I'm not, you know, we don't run the company where like we're making a dinosaur movie because I want to make a dinosaur movie. You're all going to make a dinosaur. You're not going to get the best out of your team. Right. So I remember spending, I think it was like two or three weeks during the weekend, just in UEFN, kind of migrating some assets that really roughly not optimized at all. And just kind of getting some up and running. I had some up and running within 24 hours, by the way, which is so freaking quick. Wow. Had some up and running. And the cool thing is, you're not just up and running locally, because the thing, when you make a Fortnite game, it's not like making a typical video game. So what that means is, like, for example, the Xbox project we're doing at the moment, we do some work in Unreal, we press the play button and your controller, then you start playing the game, right? Very, very quick, you can debug and so on. When you do a Fortnite game, it's not like that. So if you want to test or play test anything you've done, you can't just hit the play button. There is no play button in UEFN. You got to upload it onto a private server, because it's an online game, right? It uses servers. But before your game even gets to the private server, it has to go through a validation check. So it does a validation check of making sure your textures are 2K or less, making sure you don't have any odd blueprints that don't work or Niagara effects that are memory intensive. Oh, I forgot to mention, your entire game has to be no more than 400 megabytes.
Yep.
Everything. Like everything. I remember chatting to one of my artists and they're like, my Photoshop file is fucking 400 meg. Like, how right. am I gonna make a game with cinematics? And I'm like, dude, PS2 days, man. Video memory was low. We still got amazing games. So it becomes an exercise optimization. So anyway, so I did a little kind of like a test level with the characters in and the moon level and all of that. And I just sent the link to my team. Said, hey guys, play this. They're like, well, we're playing a Fortnite game. And like a lot of them were Fortnite players. And they go, this is really cool, man. What is this? I'm like, I think that's what we should make next. They go, we're in. I didn't even need the picture. I don't know why I bothered building the pictures. They were in anyway. They go, we're in. So, and it was a really good way because not only have I used that as a pitch material, I've used UEFN to pitch my team to do a UEFN project with me, but it inspires everyone because they can see, even though it was very rough and clunky, the test I did, it inspired them. Go, this could be something really cool if we all get together and make something. And our team, originally it was just myself. And then we bought on Ernesto, who's our lead TD. And then we bought on Sam, who did level design. So he'll take my proxy level and make it way better than what I did. And then we had Ryan Fleming, who's now our lead UEFN guy. And he came on board. He optimized the hell out of it, like really optimized the hell out of it. And I think UEFN for us became like Unreal Engine 5, kind of became the filmmaking tool for us in terms of making us all really good filmmakers and experimenting. UEFN really taught us how to make sort of like premium quality cinematic experiences, but optimized. Optimization was key. So you've got to be smart in how you build your levels. You've got to be smart on when to use the Niagara effects, how to manage memory. We also had to learn Verse. Now, we're not expert in Verse, and like, I mean, programming freaks me out a little bit, but we had to dive into Verse. So when you play the game, there's all these meteorites that are, you know, raining, showering down, hitting the moon's surface. And we couldn't just have a looping particle because that's going to drain the game memory. And most importantly, if six people are playing this multiplayer, it's going to be an awful experience, right? Doesn't matter how amazing your game looks. If it plays horrible, it plays horrible. So we use Verse to create our own meteorite system, which Ernesto ended up developing our own Verse system. So not only now have we come out of our comfort zone, we're making something for Fortnite players. So the other thing we had to do was like watch a lot of Fortnite videos, like TikTok videos of what Fortnite players want. Because look, there's one thing making your own IP. And then there's another thing of making your own IP and kind of putting it into the hands of an already established audience base that are in Fortnite. So there's a level of expectancy required that Fortnite players want from your Fortnite game. There's also a level of familiarity, like they've got to be familiar with some of the mechanics, but then you throw in and sprinkle in something new. So for us, we sprinkled in a brand new world that they've never seen before. That it's a moon landscape, there are meteorites crashing, there are monsters, there's all of that adventure-y style stuff. And then you can ride buggies that go across the landscape. But we also added in sort of like mechanics as well. Like, so one big mechanic is like, there's this floating astronaut, like the survivors of the crash, right? They're only floating around in, and they've got 10 alien tentacles attached to them. And one of the mechanics we built was that you've got to like, you know, press the button so that the tentacles go off and you save your astronaut. So there's a saving mechanism, which didn't really exist in Fortnite until we brought that in. So we did all of that. And obviously we then released the first version. I think it was July the 28th. We did like, we call it alpha, and just to see what it's like, we've got really good reactions. Actually, we're really surprised, like, oh, thank God. And I think that's because of familiarity, right? For those listening, by the way, you cannot change the player character in UEFN. So that's the thing you got to remember. So that's the thing. There are a lot of limitations to UEFN. Okay. I mean, the big one obviously being 400 megabytes. You got to be really smart how you build your world and mechanics and the devices that you use. Devices are basically things that make things happen in Fortnite. And there's a lot of them, but they take a lot of memory. But also, you got to remember that the playable character is always going to be a Fortnite character because obviously Epic sells skins. And obviously, the playable character, the whole mechanics and architecture fits well in the way Fortnite's built. But everything outside of your player character, your NPCs, your non-playable characters, your environments, your effects, anything else, you can bring what you want, within reason, obviously. So one of the things we did was we used a lot of mega scans, and we had to optimize mega scan. And this, the other thing also we realized was what really helped about optimization was they have nanite inside of UEFN, they have world partitioning. And we're like, whoa, world partitioning? Okay, this is a whole different level. So it allowed us to make, when you play the game, you'll see it feels bigger than it is. And that's because of the world partitioning. Like, yeah, you could jump up in the air and you can see the moon landscape going off into the distance with no LOD flickering or anything, which we were like pretty impressed. Like, wow, that's pretty cool. So we did that and we tested it and we got a lot of feedback on Twitter. And the big feedback we saw, in fact, it wasn't actually people giving feedback, is the observation. We were watching people play. And towards the end of the mission, originally, you had to collect 3 keys in order to activate the shuttle, in order to jump in the shuttle and make it back home to Earth, right? So for those listening who don't know about Moontopia, the idea is you're an astronaut, your ship has crashed, and you've got like X amount of time left on your oxygen to make it across to Moontopia, which is a moon base, which everyone's evacuated apart from 1 or 2 spaceships that are still there. And the plan is you go into, you fight the alien monsters that came from the meteorites, and you save the astronauts, take them all into the spaceship and make it home. It's a simple plot, right? It's kind of like your typical sci-fi survival plot. So which worked really well in Fortnite. But we were watching people play, and because it's a multiplayer game, so someone would grab a key and someone would shoot that person and the key would fly off and they'll go and grab the key, which is cool. But when the guy's on the edge of the map and they get shot and that key flies off the map, what do you do? So it became, we could hear people on the heads go, oh God, dude. And they're like cursing.
Where's
like,
the key?
Yeah, where's the key? Oh, this sucks, man. So you're like, oh, okay. So that then, we went back to the drawing board and myself, Ryan and Sam and Ernesto, we all sat there going like, maybe getting a key isn't a good idea. What are other type of things that will make the game sticky? Because that's the thing about Fortnite. They're very sticky, those games. Like, you want to be replayable factors, make it very addictive. But multiplayer. See, there's one thing making a solo experience, right? Where you're an adventurer trying to survive and get to the end. But when you're playing 6 people, the whole mechanics change. The way you design the levels change. You got to be a little bit bigger. You got to like account for 6 players, right? So we decided, what if you got to collect a fixed number of coins and feed that coin into the machine that's on the side of the shuttle. And once you get all that 150 coins, whoever gets 150 coins gets a ticket and you jump in. And we thought, let's try that. And I think they did something like that in Call of Duty or something. So we tested it and we were having fun testing it. And that's when we realized if you as a developer is having fun playing it, then it's most likely your audience is going to have some fun. And that was very, very important for us. So we did that, and then what we decided was, what are we making? Are we making an island or are we making a game? Technically, everything in Fortnite is an island, right? But we didn't just want to make a sandbox island. I was very clear that we want to make something that acts like a product. So Moontopia is essentially an IP, which can be an animated film, can be a video game, can be a feature film, can be an Xbox game, but also a Fortnite experience. Could be a Roblox experience, who knows? But Fortnite is the first place that's actually exposed the IP to the audience. But we also wanted to grow the game within Fortnite. And this is where the whole community aspect is very cool. So we built a Discord channel, which we're going to announce later this week. And we kind of want the community to help shape the game. And like every 3 or 4 months, or maybe quicker than that, we'll do updates, expansions, kind of like what Cyberpunk does, where they do expansions, or No Man's Sky. So we kind of want to keep doing expansions. But of course, we've got to remember 400 megabytes. Got to be very smart on how we do this. But yeah, so that's kind of like where we are. And that's how we pretty much got the game up and running. It took us about 3 months, by the way, of a team of like, I think it was like 3 or 4 people in total. Wow. Actually, the cool thing is when you're in the lobby, you know, as you're waiting for the game to start, you can actually walk and there's like a little billboard with everyone's names on the credits. I thought it'd be nice to immortalize everyone in the game. So yes, you can see who was involved.
That's awesome. And amazing what you can do with a smaller crew these days, given these tools.
And restrictions. And you do a lot with restrictions as well. Now, just an FYI, it took 3 months to do that. But remember, we had done a lot of the art already in the cinematic trailer. So like the astronauts were built, the monsters were built, and all of that, the terrains were built. So a lot of it was just optimizing and playing the game mechanics and making sure the shaders react correctly, because obviously when you bring stuff from UE5 or UE5.1 into UEFN, UEFN is Unreal 5.2 Lite now, I think it is. And that doesn't necessarily mean that every Niagara effect's going to work. Like, when we had certain blueprints that broke, we're like, I don't understand, why is it broken? And you go in there and like there's all these red nodes. You're like, oh, those red nodes exist in 5.2, but they don't necessarily exist in 5.2 Lite, which is UEFN. So then you have to delete those nodes and kind of rebuild it again to make it work. But the main foundation's there. So yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm sure that this is like the first number of months that UEFN's existed. And I'm sure that some of these things you're talking about, the limits, the functionality, will evolve over time.
100%. Well, yeah, that's a very good point you brought up there, man, because, you know, we're saying Unreal was like a beta, right? But UEFN is extremely beta. I mean, if anything, I think it's alpha more than beta, to be honest with you, because there are certain things that when we were the first to jump in as well. You know, we jumped, like literally when me and you were at Game Develop, that's when I decided we're going to go make this. So a lot of things changed. But like, for example, like 2 weeks ago, like UEFN just announced a new device called Save Progress. So now, you know, if you die, it will respawn you back in the place you died. It doesn't respawn you from the beginning, but also it means you can save your progress as well, which is something that only existed in Fortnite Creative. So that's the other thing also you got to remember, like Fortnite Creator has been around for years, and that's how people have been building maps and monetizing as well, from what I'm hearing. Whereas UEFN is slowly becoming its thing, like much more premium level quality with Unreal Engine attached to it. But also it's starting to take some of those devices, you know, those things that make Fortnite work, and bringing that into UEFN. So pretty much like every update we announce is based on a UEFN update, literally.
Right.
Yeah.
As it becomes available in your game.
Exactly.
And what's the creator economy experience that you've had so far?
Very, very good question. In fact, everyone asked me that because they're like, it's the most important thing. At the moment, it's all based on metrics and it's all based on player retention. And again, this is a brand new model for us. I've never worked in a what you call free-to-play game model. You know, we build something, we get it financed, we sell it, we make money just like you do on a movie. But free-to-play is different. So the game is for free and most free-to-play games make money with in-app purchases or loot boxes. You can't do none of those in Fortnite, right? Fortnite restricts you from doing any of that. So how do I monetize my Fortnite game? And it really literally is eyeballs, numbers, but also player retention, which is the more people stay in your game. So you may just only have 5 people, right? But if they've stayed in there for 20 or 30 minutes, as opposed to 20 people playing the game, only spending like, I don't know, 5 seconds and then quitting, you probably get more return on the 5 people because they stayed longer in your game. So that means that you have to make your game sticky and replayable as much as possible. But what you do is every month or 2 months, you check in you log into your creator portal and see the metrics. And the metric will tell you, you know, this week you had more player retention, this week you dropped down and so on. And after a few months, you get like a payout, you know, whether it's $100 here, $200 or less or more. And then that goes directly into your account. Now, in order to be qualified for monetization, you have to submit your tax forms. Mm-hmm. So they really check. And I think it's a really good thing that Epic does is they are really strict on checking, making sure that, you know, you have a company, you have a bank account that is not somewhere in the Cayman Islands or something, but a legit bank account. And that, you know, that Epic will not get sued if they're, you know, paying you money for your island. So there's that. The other thing, which is a most recent thing, which I like to share, is ratings. Mm. So I think it's IARC, I think they're called, IARC, which is kind of like ESRB ratings and so on. That's very strict. When it came out a few weeks ago, so how it works is every time you publish your change, so I released the game yesterday, right? And today I've got some changes. I have to republish the game. It's not like I just press update and it updates it. You have to resubmit it again, right? And the ratings check if your game has strong level of violence, checks if there's sexual content or anything derogatory, all of that stuff. And they actually ask you, do you have swastikas in your level? Do you have like, you know, really crude content? I don't know why anyone would say yes to a lot of this stuff. Does it promote terrorism? But it's like being at a customs passport.
It's like immigration.
It's like immigration. Literally, like immigration. It's the same question but three different ways. Exactly. But they do that, and then you get a rating. So when we first did ours, we got ours came out as general rating. But then I think literally last night, we got asked by Epic, hey, you got to resubmit your questionnaire because, you know, we've made them much more stricter. So now, before it says, is your game violent? Yes or no? I'm like, nope. Now I have to press yes, because if you hit the question mark button on the side, violence doesn't necessarily mean blood and guts. Someone running around shooting a laser gun at a rock is considered as violence. So now you have to kind of rethink when you're making your game mechanics and making your game, that what is your target audience? We're clearly not just hitting general, we're hitting sort of like PEGI 13 or PEGI 10 plus, right? Which is a whole different thing. So now that questionnaire is much more detailed. You're going in, it's okay, if it's violent, is it realistic violent or fantasy violent? It's fantasy violent. Okay, what level of fantasy violence is it? And it really breaks it down. Now, as annoying as it is you do it once, right? You only do it again if you've made a massive change in your game that warrants a recertification for ratings, but which we're not going to do, because for us, you know, the game's always going to be that game. But one thing that's really interesting is, we originally had these monsters, right? We had these like tentacle monsters. And for those who are following Moontopia earlier, you would have seen the original monsters. They were textured and looked kind of cool. They had teeth and stuff. I remember Epic came back to us and said, hey, listen, you know, we'll never ask you to change your game. It's not what we do. But it will fail the ratings because it's got teeth and tentacles. I'm like, it's got teeth and tentacles. We've got a game shooting people. But you got to understand, from a legal point of view, that could be considered as horror. So if anything, it was a silver lining for us. We went back and we made the monster way cooler. We took the teeth out. We replaced the skin texture with some sort of like bioluminosity. Kind of like, you know that movie The Abyss, the James Cameron movie The Abyss? We kind of made it something that looked like that. And it was like,
yeah, oh, cool.
Thank God for legal ratings. It actually inspired us creatively to make it better. And the other thing that we failed on was the astronauts. So in the original version, we had the astronauts just floating unconsciously. And that could be seen as like having dead people, which is like not a good thing in a game in that where it's Fortnite players are, you know, 12-year-olds. So we then just, it's a very easy fix. We just jump into our, you know, our motion capture suit and just did some like wavies, help me kind of thing, fixed. So my point is, like, even when you're up against legal obstacles or rating obstacles, as a creator, there's always ways of fixing that. If anything, it makes your game better with those restrictions.
Wow. Wow, that's really cool to hear about, Ian, and all the way through the economic model through to the ratings model, because it the picture that it paints for me is that the company behind this cares about what's in this and cares about, yes, who's consuming it, and also they care about the outcome. And are people actually using it? Are they enjoying it? Are they persisting in it? Not just could you sell it in the first place, but like, are you actually, is it actually enjoyable to stay in it? That's really unique.
Yeah, no, it is. And it, you know, the guys at Epic are really cool. There's a lot of support we get from the UEFN team. You know, they want creators to succeed. I think that's the thing that I can see is evidently they really want you to succeed, but at the same time, they can't tell you how to make your game. You know, they can't tell you to remove stuff from your game. That's ultimately up to you. All they can do is flag something, and that's it. So, yeah.
Well, that's super cool. And we got a few questions that have come in.
Yeah, bring it on.
So, someone's asking, you talked about film versus game animation. Someone is interested in using Fortnite to develop interactive narratives. Can you speak to that?
So, it's the question that can we do this kind of stuff in Fortnite?
Well, like, I guess I'm guessing if the person who asked the question wants to add any detail, feel free. But I think it sounds like, is there anything unique in Fortnite for developing more narrative experience as opposed to just a straight up consumptive movie or a game, traditional game?
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. I mean, the way to look at Fortnite is it's essentially you are building a game within a game, right? That's the cool thing. Like, if we were to make Moontopia from scratch, we would have to build all of these things that you get free with Fortnite, which is the idea to bring in worlds, bring in mechanics. We have actually a very strong narrative in Miintopia. You know, we actually open the game with a 20-second cinematic, all in-game as well. So that's the other thing you got to remember, is that you're not playing pre-rendered videos, you're playing in-game cinematics. So when the cinematic plays, it's got to end in a way that your player would then continue playing from that point onwards. But also, there's a lot you can do in Fortnite with narrative as well, like, you know, having your NPCs say certain dialogue or speech bubbles or whatever you want to do. You know, we've designed the map in a way that kind of tells a story as you play it. Like, you go from crash site to, like, which is ground zero, right through to, like, where the aliens are holding the astronauts, so you get a bit of story there, right through to ziplining across the monster's lair. You see, oh my god, this is how the monsters came here. They actually crash land because it's a big, massive meteorite crater. So there's a lot of visual narrative you can do. So, I mean, everyone tells a story very differently. Like, I love visual narrative, and I feel like Fortnite really pushed me as a filmmaker to really push the visual narrative side of things, as opposed to relying on, like, long scrolling text or lots of cinematics.
Right. That's really cool. Experiential narrative.
Yes.
Somebody's curious about what some of the alpha limitations or bugs or anything that you're experiencing.
Yeah, there's quite a few. Where do I start? I mean, obviously the 400 meg thing is a big thing, but also, like, sometimes when you send your game onto the private server, it would fail and you're like, oh, what did I do wrong? And then you resubmit it, it's fine. Memory calculations is another thing. So remember I was saying, when you submit something on the private server to just to play test, it has to run through validation checks, but it also has a memory calculation to make sure that your game is within the 400 meg and can run smoothly. That can sometimes fail. You get memory calculation fail. You're like, I don't understand. Why is my memory calculation fail? And you find that if you just delete a device and then bring the device back in, works. So, and again, that's because it's early code. They're trying to make something work stable. Of course, there are things like certain things don't migrate very well from Unreal Engine 5, specifically complex blueprints. So if you've got a character, the way your character is set up, if you've got a specific blueprint that constructs your character, because obviously when you make a game character, it's all modular. Whereas when you're making a film, it's all like one big mesh of a skeleton. But games are all very modular, so you can switch between different hairstyles and so on. And if you built that in Unreal Engine 5 and migrate that, it may not work. So you gotta be prepared to rebuild that. That isn't really a bug. That's just the way Fortnite UFN works.
Feature.
It's a feature. But there are other things, like, for example, you got to be careful putting things like advertising in Fortnite, because I think they somehow flag it and they don't allow that. Even having website links, I don't think you can do a website link, but advertising, like, go to this website, that's usually a big no. Again, not a bug, it's more of a restriction if you are trying to create something for brands. So a lot of ad agencies are using Fortnite. I think I remember reading somewhere, obviously Nike did one, Mayonnaise did one. They did a big Mayonnaise game. I've really got to play that, see what that's like. So you got to rethink the way you do advertising or branded content in Fortnite that isn't like, buy this for this price. So a lot of, like, these companies are kind of using Fortnite as brand awareness. By, like, so for example, the Mayonnaise game had mayonnaise, there's this flooded of mayonnaise and you're swimming in mayonnaise trying to grab stuff. And you just remember mayonnaise when you finish. You just want to have a mayonnaise sandwich or something. I think Nike had actual Nike sneaker shoes that had that. And that's okay, because that's an object. But actual text or images, you got to be careful on that.
Right. Yeah, interesting. somebody else here is saying, do you think small form narratives would work in Fortnite, such as concert experiences or immersive experiences from IP, like cartoons or TV shows?
100%, absolutely. I mean, here's the thing. Even though we're talking about limitations, those limitations are just technical limitations. They're not creative limitations at all. So what I mean is that you know, we've already had Fortnite concerts already happen, right? With Travis Scott and Ariana Grande and so on. So that's already been tried and tested. That works, right? But also things like a TV show. You could pretend, I don't know if you would do a serialized TV show, but you could essentially, just top of my head, each island you create is an episode. So episode one will be one game that you play, you immerse yourself in that content, kind of like immersive theater, right? Like Punch Drunk, you know, those kind of places. Yeah. So each of them could be its own set, its own location. We experience things differently. So yeah, you could essentially create narrative immersive experiences as each island and create a collection of those islands on one single page.
Very cool. Yeah, I've enjoyed some of those things in real life, like Sleep No More in New York.
Exactly.
Very, very interesting way of, I didn't even know the story until I got to the end, then it kind of made sense. But it was really interesting. Another question from me in terms of the style and the look is a question that comes up a lot is, I know that it's now not limited to just the Fortnite style. Yes. As you mentioned, the playable character coming from Fortnite. What are your thoughts on the look that you can create within?
Yeah, for us it was interesting because, like, you know, we didn't want to create something that was so photoreal that the Fortnite characters stand out like a sore thumb. So you kind of need to look at the Fortnite style and say, how can I elevate it further? So for us, we went with pure cinematic lighting, like photographic lighting. So everything is photographically correct, like the way the sun is positioned, the lighting of the neons and so on. But also for us, it was the detail. So if you look at the Fortnite maps, they all got a very sort of like cell shaded kind of look to them. They got a certain look, right? Which is awesome. For us, we wanted detail. So, you know, you look down on the ground, you can see all the individual stones or moon rocks. We wanted it to feel rich with so much stuff going on in the environment. So when you go to the moon base level, we've actually built a lot of the moon base using Fortnite assets. But then we built on top of that, our own assets on top of that. So it feels familiar, yet feels different. And I think that was the big thing for us to, especially for your first Fortnite game, is to create something that feels a little bit familiar, but also something that feels a little bit elevated. So that when they're playing it, they feel like, oh, this is different, but not too different that I'm put off by it. So that's it. Right. So that was a big thing for us when it comes to style.
And the interesting thing there as well is that I know the Fortnite assets don't count towards the budget, right? So you can leverage the existing assets, but they don't count towards that 400 meg.
I think it does count, but not as big as it would be. Like our moon terrain, we built the moon terrain in segments. So we didn't just build one big massive moon terrain. We built a collection of six or seven kind of components. We just slot together, rotate them and stuff. So this seems to look well. And that helped as opposed to having one big massive terrain. But that took a big chunk, by the way, because of the detail we wanted on there.
Yeah.
Because it's got undulations and bumps. So when you're driving the buggy, you actually fly up in the air. Oh, the other thing also, we tweaked the zero G gravity as well. So when you play it, it does feel quite floaty, which is kind of cool.
Awesome. That's great.
But when you use the Fortnite assets, they're so well optimized. Mm. Like one could say, no, they don't take any of the budget, but they do. Because when you look at if you go to, I think, like memory or something, it tells you all the things that are eating up memory. You have your textures, your geometry, your nanites, and your lighting, you know, all of that. It tells you how much you use. And the Fortnite devices are in there as well. Like every device you use counts as a memory. So, like, you know, we have a device, a timer device. So the minute you enter the doors of the Moontopia, a timer goes off. You have 5 minutes to get all the coins before the shuttle leave. And they go, that's a device. And that takes up memory because that's a collection of code that has to be run in real time, right? So yeah,
got it. So they do take up that.
Yeah, but not as much as like bringing a big massive mega scan, that's for sure.
Yeah, and it's interesting that, sorry, got that part wrong. The other interesting things in terms of the look and photorealism often takes very dense geometry and very high resolution textures, and those are obviously going to eat into that limitation a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you got to really, really embrace tiling when you're doing your textures. Tile the hell out of it. Obviously, it has PBR, you know, photo-based rendering capabilities in terms of shaders. So a lot of work in your shaders has to be really smart. But you don't need anything more than 2K. In fact, some of our textures are like 1024 by 1024. It's probably the highest. You know, we originally had 4K textures. And we realized we don't need it because it's such a fast-paced game. And when you're playing multiplayer, no one is stopping and looking at, ooh, look how cool your textures are. They're just playing it. And I'd rather have a slightly pixely texture on a building than have a game that is lagging at like 15 frames per second. I'd rather sacrifice the texture quality to give 60 frames per second to a player as opposed to the other way around.
Right. Yeah, no, that's cool. Yeah, and I'm sure that some of these things will, as technology inevitably advances, that some of these things will start to improve in terms of the limits and the power of
Oh, it's
hardware.
growing. I mean, UEFN is growing. I mean, every few weeks we see like updates in the newsletter, like the stuff that these guys are doing. They're bringing more devices in. There's loads of things are being updated. Yeah, and that's why it kind of feels good to jump in. Like now is the time for anyone that wants to get into UEFN. Now's the time to dive in because I feel like if you grow with the software, you kind of appreciate it much more as well.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, and the power of mobile devices is starting to really increase, I'm sure, because that's where the bottom end of this needs to run on low power.
Well, that's an interesting thing because when we do the play test, I play test on my PC. I also play test on my PS5 because it's an island code, right? This is the other thing that's really cool, by the way, man. You know, we mentioned earlier, like, you know, what were the advantages? Like, we talked about, you know, 500 million plus user base. You know, you have a game engine to make something, but also the accessibility of the game. Like, right now, if you wanted to play our current game that we developed on the Xbox console, I couldn't get you to play it unless I give you a specific link that you download, install with all the SDK libraries and Microsoft C++ visual library binaries, all of that stuff, which is complex. Just play a demo. Whereas with this, the minute it goes onto the Fortnite server, and that's the other thing I forgot to mention. So much to tell you, but the thing I forgot to mention is once you've got it on a private server and you're play testing. So we play tests on PS5, Ryan's on a PC, Andreas on an Xbox, and then I tested it on my Galaxy Fold phone. So you know the one that opens up. And I can play because it's Android, right? Obviously, you can't play on an Apple iOS for obvious reasons, but it plays, and I'm playing. Like, this is really good. It's optimized for the phone, so not only is it about the audience base, it just means like I can get my mom to play the Fortnite game. She doesn't need to be technically savvy. She just go into Fortnite, copy and paste the island code into Discover Islands, and off you go. So accessibility is very big thing. When you're an independent developer or independent creator, you want your content into people's hands as quick as possible, but you don't have a massive marketing budget. Ease of access is the way forward for sure.
Right, yeah, the reducing the friction in getting people to be able to explore and experiment with it.
Exactly. But remember though, when you put it on the private server, so when you're play testing internally, you put it on a private server once it's passed its memory calc and validation. Only the people that are in your project list. So when you create a UEFN project, it's all online called a creator portal. You add the Epic IDs of all of your developer team on there, and only them can play that island code on any of their consoles, but they can only access it. But when you're ready for the public to see it, you got to hit the green button, and that's the publishing button. And in the publishing button, you upload a thumbnail, you put the description, you put like what are the keywords that describe your game, you put on a trailer. Sometimes it's really good to have it. So we got a really cool trailer we edited. And then you go through the IARC age ratings, you go through that questionnaire, and you hit publish. Now it could take between 24 hours to 48 hours or 72 hours, depending on how busy Epic, you know, the validation team is doing. And then if you get a green light on your portal, boom, that code is now live. If you get an orange, it means it's failed something. And usually it's probably because your image, you're using the Fortnite logo wrong, for example. So that's why I say to everyone, before you hit publish, go onto the Fortnite guidelines, read those guidelines. Because you have one thing wrong, or you have your image at a different aspect ratio, it would fail it instantly.
That makes sense. Good, great advice there. And yeah, I saw your poster on your phone, Moontopia, with the fold.
Yay!
I ended up getting it, and I have fallen in love with it.
It's
Not
cool, isn't
very cool. Yeah, not sponsored by Samsung,
it?
everybody,
Not sponsored by Samsung.
but it's so cool having a bigger screen. It's like,
Yeah.
yeah, real game changer.
Totally.
I'd love to hear anything else that you're there's always so many things I want to ask you. I'm gonna have to bring you back on another episode. But I know that you're working on, well, I guess one question I've got in terms of the number of things that you're working on, and I know you're not a giant team.
No.
You have a bigger team than when you started, but how do you any advice for people to like manage time and resources and assets and project management? Like, how do you cope with this many things?
That is the bane of my life. Time. Time is, man, you know, it's kind of like, this is getting a little philosophical now, but like, I think the older you get, you start to realize, oh my God, I'm 45. I've only got like, maybe like live up to 80 or 90 if I'm healthy. So I've only got X amount of time. And you're like, okay, and you start doing the maths. Okay, if I spend this amount of time on this project, it's got to be something that I really care about, because once I've used up 1 second of my time, 1 minute of my time, that's it. It's gone. I can't take that back. Right. So you start being very picky, and also you start to manage your time better. You just, the older you get, you start forcing yourself to manage time better. My business partner, Paula Crickard, that's the biggest nightmare for her is managing my time. Cause I'm like, let's make everything. Let's make a Roblox game. You're like, whoa, it's only something. And also you got to remember quality as well. Like, you can do a million things, but if they're all at the okay-ish level, it doesn't really get you anywhere. So this is why when we made a Fortnite game, we're like, we're just gonna make this one Fortnite game, and we're gonna make it the best possible Fortnite game we could ever make, or the best we can, right? And see how that goes before we start committing more resources and time to making more Moontopia. But also, like, you know, like at the moment, I did say that we don't do third party work, we don't do servicing work. We're an IP original IP content creation company. But I'm directing the cinematics for Legendary and Funcom's Dune game. Yes, the game with the sandworms. And and again, I was very picky. I'm like, you know, I don't really want to work for another company, because I've kind of done that for like my decades of career. But it's Dune, and I'm going to learn a shit ton of stuff. And the team are amazing at Funcom, and they're allowing our company to plug into their pipeline, and it allows the team to grow to work on a AAA game. Then, yeah, this is good use of my time. Absolutely. And the next movie we're doing at the moment is Mutant Year Zero, as I said earlier. And that's our film that's in production with Seth Manoffice in Belfast. So now my time is really like, I still am on the box. I'm still in Unreal. Technically, I shouldn't be, but I'm still in on the box. And I feel like, and I don't think I'll ever change that. I think it'll be less, instead of me, like on Rift, I'll like create the entire shot, right? I'll bring all the environments in, I'll animate, I'll do everything right through to light and everything. Now, you know, we have an amazing team. We have heads of departments. We have leads. I have a production assistant. I have production managers. So Finn's now, you start to use your time a bit better, but I'm so glad I'm still hands-on, because when I'm giving direction, I hate saying, hey, could you move the camera 2 pixels to the left, 90 degrees? I'm like, screw it. Let me just let Unreal show it to you right in the shot, right there. It's done. Don't worry about the camera, guys. It's signed off. Work on the stuff that I can't do very well, which is the amazing characters, explosions, the environments. So I think it's helpful to be hands-on. I get a lot of directors asking me, like, yeah, but I want to direct, but I don't want to use a computer. I'm like, well, just look at the computer like an Arri Alexa camera, kind of, or your viewfinder, or whatever tools you use on live action. Just treat Unreal like that. And to me, I use now Unreal as a way to communicate things. Even on the big studio project like Dune, even though I'm not in there coding stuff and making a game, because they have like 500 people doing that, I'm still communicating inside of Unreal. I'm still in sequencer, blocking shots out. I'm still in sequencer, adjusting edits, because that's the kind of filmmaker I've become. And then there's a lot of filmmakers. That Mark Cheng's a good example. He's that kind of filmmaker. And there's a bunch of other filmmakers out there that are doing amazing work. And they've become that filmmaker because they're very hands-on. And even though the project they do are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're getting less and less hands-on on the box, they still have the ability to go in and make those, communicate those changes, because you're hands-on artists.
Right. Yeah, it's so empowering to be able to do the things that you would do on a real film set, but do it in a virtual space.
It's communication, dude. Like, I'd rather have a 10-second meeting showing the camera move as opposed to a 15-minute meeting on like what the camera is and these are the references, and, you know, go on YouTube, find this reference. I'm like, oh my God, let me just show you what I'm talking about. And sometimes what you have in your head seems like it's cool until you move the camera and frame. You're like, ooh, that does not look good. Thank God I tried that out before I pitched it to the team. So yeah.
Right. Yeah, well, you're a fantastic commercial for people being more hands-on with this. I think we see a lot of people come through the schools as saying, I just want to know about it. I don't really want to use it. I want to tell other people how to use it. But when they actually experience. You don't have to learn the entire engine. Ooh, you can just learn part of it.
I can't create blueprints from scratch. I mean, I can operate. I can look at a blueprint. I can make some node changes. For me, I live in Sequencer. Sequencer is my day-to-day thing. Cameras and sequencers, all I know. That's the only thing I know really well as an Unreal Engine artist. Whereas Andrea is the blueprint master. He does C++. He builds systems in Unreal, but he's not 100% comfortable in Sequencer like I am. So I always say to people, find the thing that you love doing as, I don't want to use the word task, but the thing that you love doing as part of your job. So if you're a production designer, you just love bringing assets together and connecting them up, but you may not know how to render the thing. You may not know how to light it, but that's okay. You can just look at it in on lit mode and see things moving. You know, you can just construct stuff. If you are an animator, you don't want to know about cameras or lighting. I just want to know, how do I use control rig to add additional joints for my character or my monster? So, and then you become really good at control rig, but you're not necessarily good at sequencer or blueprints or so on. So you'll never know Unreal Engine inside out. I don't think the people at Epic do either. I think it's like, whatever you use it for your job, just be really good at that. And then, you know, you get other people on to help you out on the other stuff.
That's great advice. Yeah. And but also being a bit of a generalist, I think now, and
yeah,
knowing about the other things, just not necessarily being a master of them, understanding what they are.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, having an understanding is important. Like, you know, I understand simulations in Houdini. I'm not going to go and attempt to run a Houdini simulation, but I understand it enough to know that let's give people time to run simulations and to test it and make sure we have a good SSD drive in there for the caching of these simulations. If I know that, then I can plan ahead and empower my artists that are doing much better work than I could ever do in Houdini. So I think having an understanding is important. And yeah, you're right. There are a lot of people that don't want to touch Unreal because I just need to know what it's about. I'm a producer. I'm a producer. I deal with numbers on a day-to-day basis. But I find that if I'm in Unreal and I just have a look around and stuff, I feel like I'm qualified to say yes. We are going to do it this way, even though I don't know how we're going to do it. But I feel like, yeah, we're using Unreal because, you know, I've been in it. It's kind of like saying, if someone's saying, oh, yeah, you know, I love flying, but I'll never get into an airplane. You kind of got to get into an airplane to fly. So, yeah, I think that's a big thing. And I think and Unreal's getting easier, dude. Like, there's so much education. I mean, look, you guys are doing it at CG Pro. I mean, not that I'm here to plug you guys. I should
go ahead. I don't mind.
But what you guys are doing is pretty cool because, like, when I started out, there wasn't anything like CG Pro that I could go to. Go, hey, there's a training facility or a training initiative out there that supports people from all over the industry. You don't just have to be in the CG industry. You can be automotive, whatever, or just a hobbyist. And I know there's a place that I could just go and join a community and learn about and do courses. You know, that's a good thing. And I think there's going to be a lot of more of these kind of things, like, you know, educational support from Epic, for example, their forums. So there really isn't any excuse for people not to at least install it and open it, right?
Especially right now, while it's free. Grab it.
Right. Well, I mean, come on, let's be fair. It'll always be free. I think it'll always be free. I think if you're a commercial, like the video games, right? You make a video game in Unreal. At the moment, you make a video game in Unreal. And if your game makes $1 million, then you pay a royalty fee.
That's right.
Let's face it, man. If your game's made $1 million, you should be fine to pay a friggin' royalty fee, okay?
Yeah. And, so, and the same if you're, I think the same thing. We're yet to find out what's going to happen in the rest
for film
of it,
and TV. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think from what you hear from them so far, that it's most likely going to be free in education. It's going to be free under a revenue limit, which has probably been quite generous knowing Epic. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think if everyone thought that Unreal was going to be free for life, you got to look at the way business works, right? So, I mean, you know, I think what these guys are doing is creating high-level tools that's empowering people that are from the premium level down to the hobbyist level and putting everyone on the same playing field. And I think that's massive. And so if they do say, hey, you know, if you're a company that's making X amount of revenue and we need you to pay a little bit to help Unreal keep doing what it's doing, yeah, why not, right?
Yep. No, I think it's a really important point because there's a lot of that message out there of people, everybody wants things that are great and things to be free. And you know, there's thousands of people working extraordinarily hard on this thing full time. Like that costs money to do. And it's only great because there's that much effort going into
it. Yeah, I mean, it's the same reason why people buy an Autodesk subscription, right? I mean, we're creating content that is going to be commercialized. Now, of course, if you're an education, or if you're a hobbyist or someone just wants to know, then no, of course you wouldn't get billed for that. But if you are creating content, like for me, I'm making an animated feature film. There is revenue coming out of that. You know, I'm directing the cinematics for a big AAA game. There's a revenue coming out for that. So of course, you know, it's like if you're a plumber, you're gonna buy some tools, right? You're not gonna get free tools from the shop. You're gonna buy your hammer, you're gonna buy your screwdriver. It's the same thing. And yeah, that's the way people gotta see it.
Absolutely. Yeah, and usually you get what you pay for.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
There's some interesting other open source tools that are quite good, like a Blender.
Blender's freaking amazing. Blender's, amazing. I mean, but that's obviously had some funding put into as well. Like, you know, they've raised a lot of money behind that. But it's an exciting time coming. Like, you know, there may be a point where open source does become part of the way a studio is set up. You know, like every studio has open source tools or one way or another. And obviously, for the other episode, we'll talk about how AI impacts the production workflow and all of that.
Yeah, that's going to get really interesting, and something for another episode, as you say. the pace of innovation right now is incredible. I think just seeing, to your other point, how that's making these tools more artist friendly and usable and accessible. That's what I'm seeing more than ever. Me and you started with the same age, 45 too. We started in the industry, and you could only learn those tools in the facility. You couldn't even find a copy of it, buy a copy of it, run it on
Flame. I remember using Flame. Like, you can't go buy Flame. You have to be at a commercial house to use Flame. Even like Shake, to a point before Apple bought it and stuff, like Shake was like, you know, you had to use it at the studio. So I think we're in a very fortunate world at the moment where we have access to tools, access to education to learn the stuff. And really the ball is in the creator's court to take the next step, you know?
Well, has anything that you'd like to else that you'd like to share with people before
we wrap up? As if it wasn't enough. No, I would say please go and play Moontopia, and the guys will leave the code in Facebook and so on. Already please done. Play the game. Feedback. Let us know how you feel, and most importantly, I hope that Moontopia inspires you guys to go off and make UEFN projects as well.
Fantastic. Well, anywhere that people can find you, follow you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm usually accessible on LinkedIn, so feel free to add me on LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram as under HasDazzle. I didn't come up the name. Usually Instagram and LinkedIn, you'll find me. On Twitter as well, you can find me as HasDalol on there as well. But yeah, please do. And also, I'll post the link to the Discord channel this week on social, so I'd love to see you guys in it. But yeah, play the game and keep creating.
Fantastic. Yeah, do share us and with us any links to your community so that we can share them in ours. And
thanks, man.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule to chat with us and with the community. It's been a total pleasure.
Likewise. Thanks, man. Bye.
Thanks, Haz. Thanks also to our audience. Thanks for joining us today, asking great questions. And we'll be back again with another episode in 2 weeks. And follow us at becomecgpro.com if you're interested in us as a premier Unreal authorized training center. It's a mouthful. We're at school, we teach people, so come and check out some of the things that we do. But we'll see you all again in a couple of weeks. Go out there and make cool art and share it with the world.